And good afternoon. It is 12:02 on a rainy Friday afternoon. I'm Eric Scott, and of course, our guest, as always, Senator Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader, actually, and Wolfboro resident. Senator, thank you for being on with us again this week.
Yeah, always a pleasure. How are you?
I am very well, sir. Any plans for this weekend?
We're going to visit family.
Oh, that sounds good. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's get right to it. You remember a couple of weeks ago, or actually it was, maybe a couple of weeks ago, the Executive Council declined a pot of federal money for vaccine awareness.
Yep.
But yet, I just found out, was it yesterday, that they accepted $6 million to help immunize kids.
Well, I think that's what the, and I think it was actually $20 million. And I think that was part, Eric, of the $27 million that got rejected a couple of weeks ago. I'm not exactly sure what changed in their mind, but I'm glad I agree with Governor Sununu. I'm glad they accepted the money. I think it's one thing to, make sure that vaccines are available to people, but we should not be in the business of mandating vaccines at all. That's what a bill that I worked on, in the 2021 session, House Bill 220, make sure the government in New Hampshire doesn't mandate vaccines. Obviously, President Biden has a different view on that, and I'm glad that Governor Sununu has joined the lawsuit against it. I think it's an overreach. I suspect it's unconstitutional, firing people because they don't want to get vaccinated, especially in a state like New Hampshire, when almost 80% of the public in New Hampshire has received at least one dose of the vaccine, and we're one of the highest percentage states in the country. I don't think it's appropriate to be holding that sword over people's head that they're going to lose the ability to provide for their families, lose their job, et cetera. There are a lot of problems that this mandate, is having in terms of the supply chain, public safety, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So far, the governors that have filed lawsuit have gotten an injunction. Hopefully that injunction holds up. We should be encouraging people that it's appropriate for to get vaccines, but I don't think everybody absolutely has to get a vaccine. And kids, in particular, it's been now approved, so parents, if they want to vaccinate their kids, that's fine. That's one thing. But mandatory vaccines for school-age children when they are the least at risk, I don't think we should go there where the vaccine is less than a year old. It's been tested, but I think people still have questions, legitimate questions as to its long-term impact and its safety. And I think I'm fully vaccinated and I recently got the booster. So I made a decision of what was right for me. I shouldn't have, especially if I was a public safety worker, healthcare worker, any other worker, that sword over my head that if I don't get vaccinated, I'm going to lose my job. And here's why. I'm fully vaccinated with a booster. I can still get COVID. The vaccine minimizes the symptoms and totally diminishes my risk of getting, very sick, hopefully. It's not, nothing's 100%. But that's the reason why I took the vaccine. But I still can get COVID, and I still can spread COVID
right.
to somebody vaccinated or not vaccinated. So the rationale for mandatory vaccines at the threat of losing your job, I think, is increasingly being shown to be unnecessary. I said this, I'm sure, on with you on the radio before. The best policy for the President of the United States is to say please and thank you and present the evidence as to, you know, the risks and benefits. And I think, at least in my case, and I think in most people's cases, because nearly 80% of New Hampshire folks have decided to get vaccinated, they've decided that the risks are not as good as not as big as the benefits. The benefits far outweigh the risks. But if you're a young man, there is. It's rare, but myocarditis is an issue. If you're a woman of childbearing age, that can be an issue. If you've already gotten COVID, you have better immunities, according to everything I've, you know, read and heard in terms of scientific studies. If you've had COVID, you have better immunities than the vaccine. So this one-size-fits-all that seems more about politics to, you know, let's remember when the vaccine announced, the mandate was announced, it was right after the debacle in Afghanistan. It seems, you know, more about politics. We should be, you know, making sure that people that want to get vaccinated have access to vaccinations, to tests, to protective gear, all of that. I think that's why I know I've sort of filibustered this question, but that's why I'm glad the council accepted the money. But let's stop far short of saying, you know, you're going to lose your job or you can't go to school if you're not vaccinated. That should not be what we're doing in New Hampshire.
Would your opinion change if they were what I call escape clauses that maybe you had tested weekly or something like that to get around the vaccine mandate?
All right. So here's the deal on the testing, because, you know, for companies with over 100 employees, you can test, has to be weekly. It's expensive. It's, you know, I recently got a test that was not covered by insurance. Okay. And, you know, I had a sniffle and I had meetings that I had to go to, and I just, you know, I was trying to protect other people that might come into contact with me. So I went down to, I think it's Clear Choice in Alton, and, you know, I probably could have had it covered by Medicare because I am of that age, but I didn't have my card with me. Of course, I don't know my number, so I just said I'm going to pay $200, okay? And it was good.
Wow, for a test?
But, yeah. So wow. To think that people have to pay $200 a week, every week, you know, that's, what, $10,000 per employee? So
yeah,
the cost went up. And, you know, I think that there have been some questions about the implications of testing week after week after week and what it might, you know, what that might do to people, too. So I think it's one thing, you know, to get tested if you feel you have, you know, like a risk, like I did. I mean, I've been tested half a dozen times, you know, for travel or, you know, whatnot. But it just, the thought that, oh, yeah, we can just test everybody that doesn't want to get vaccinated, it's very impractical.
I never thought of it that way, to be honest with you. It's 1210 here on WASR, and we're talking with State Majority Leader Jeb Bradley, and, of course, a Wolfboro resident as well. Now, don't we mandate young children getting vaccinated before they start school?
Yes, we do. Okay, so polio, I'm old enough to remember the debilitating impacts of polio or smallpox. I had smallpox when I was a kid. Other childhood diseases, a couple of differences, okay? Diphtheria, tetanus, polio, even measles, mumps, and the whooping cough, they're much more debilitating for a child than COVID is. All of the evidence, not just suggests, but it's pretty well documented, Eric, that kids that, unless they have some sort of comorbidity condition, okay?
Thank you for calling WASR Radio in Wolfboro. We can't answer the phone right now.
Getting ill. Okay, so unlike polio or diphtheria or tetanus, which, you know, can have some pretty devastating effects on people, and those vaccines have been tested over the long course of time, and yes, there are some adverse reactions to those vaccines. But, you know, we've known for decades that those vaccines are safe. So I think there's a whole difference. Again, there are some kids that probably, given their health circumstances, should be vaccinated. But mandating that at this point with, you know, not the same level of research that has gone by with a polio vaccine, I think is way premature. Okay. And knowing that, you know, kids are the least at risk among us. Now, if that were to change, if there were a new variant that was deadly to kids, then, yeah, I think you think about that. But, you know, this is not polio.
No, no,
it is.
It's not.
It's devastating for people that are, you know, older than 75 and have, you know, health conditions. Those are the people that, you know, are most at risk. Kids are not that much at risk. So I think until we have better evidence about, you know, where this pandemic is going and the fact that kids so far are the least at risk, I don't see the point of mandating it.
Okay. Thank you for that, Senator. I do appreciate it. On the other hand, what happens when COVID rolls through a school, God forbid, and sets everybody back on remote learning and everything else?
Look, I think that the best thing that schools can do is, and they're doing this, maybe sometimes a little bit too much, but, you know, social distancing in the classrooms so that, you know, not every kid deals well with a mask, and I think that, you know, the masks have become, you know, a flashpoint, but certainly, you know, social distancing and, you know, breaks and managing your that way is helpful. Obviously, if there's an outbreak in a school, then maybe you do have to, for a small period of time, go back to remote learning. These are situations that I think can be managed, and we don't have to, you know, insist upon mandatory vaccines. At least that's my opinion. I think, you know, certainly the medical experts that I've seen, you know, opining on this would agree.
Okay.
It's more political discussion, I think, than a medical discussion.
Well, it's, you know, I drive by the schools coming into work every morning, and I see the kids with their little masks on, and it's like, you know, it's the world is a different place. And those of you, by the way, who are hearing some very strange noises, a lot of that has to do with the rain. For whatever reason, it always does that. I'd like to welcome in at this point Brody DeShays, who is generally also generously also volunteered to make some time with us. Brody, you with me?
Yeah. Hey, Eric. How are you? Sorry, for some reason my phone wasn't working. I think it must be the rain or something.
Yeah, I know. It happens. And Senator, again, thank you for your time as well. Let me talk to you guys about some redistricting going on. 603 Forward, a Democratic group, released a very interesting press release that said that they implore the committee to fix these maps and save our democracy. I'm not a big fan of gerrymandering, but isn't that a little over the top, Senator?
Well, you know, the redistricting plan for the congressional districts that is out there still has a long ways to go, and there'll be a lot of public input. Obviously, Brody's going to get the first shot at it before it hits the Senate. It may well change. You know, we'll see what happens. I you know, the one thing that I guess, you know, has occurred to me is that the proponents of the plan seem to be saying, if you're a Republican, as I am, that we're never going to win the second congressional district, so why should we even bother? I'm not sure that that's the case. You look at some of the recent polling, and I think a good candidate, even though it's a bit uphill on the Republican side, could win the second congressional district. So I'm cautious about that. That's the only thing I would say. But there's a long ways to go before we see it in the Senate.
So these guys are let's just say, banging the drum for a concert that hasn't started yet.
Yes, that would be an accurate description.
Okay. Brody, your comments on that?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I couldn't hear anything that the senator said. I don't know if it's because our lines aren't merged or something, but what's the question in regards to?
Oh, the question is the group 603 Forward issued a press release about redistricting and said, quote, fix these maps and save our democracy. I was just thinking that may be a little over the top.
All right. Let's talk the facts, right? 603 Forward is a progressive organization, really has no interest in a fair map. If they could have it their way, they would absolutely gerrymander it, just like we're seeing Democrats in Illinois do. They have one of the most gerrymandered proposals right now in America. So that's fact number one. Fact number two, when you look at the New Hampshire House map, both the Democratic proposal and the Republican proposal make it so then that there are less swing districts. The Democrats actually make it so then they have even fewer swing districts than the Republican proposal. So that's fact number two. Fact number three, deviation. Deviation matters. You want to get as close to the optimal number so then each representative represents the same number of people, that each person is entitled to the same number of representatives. Our deviation numbers on the New Hampshire House map is lower on average in every county than the Democrats' proposal, right? So we make it so that our per person, right, each representative represents closer to an equal number of people across the state, and we are not in any way, demonstrable way, in any way gerrymandering. The map is more than fair, and actually we have more competitive districts than the Democrats do, right? So when we talk about gerrymandering, it's all great when you're, you know, when you're the party that's not in power that's being very critical of the map. But if the maps you're proposing, right, the maps you're proposing are less competitive, less equal in representation, and make it so then there's less competitive races, it's just, you know, at a certain point, it's just complaining for the sake to complain, and quite frankly, just to fundraise. 603 Forward has never put forward a demonstrably good policy that will help Granite Staters. They support a sales tax. They support an income tax. They want to increase costs. They're supporting Biden's regressive agenda down in Washington, D.C. I mean, you know, look, let's be honest. 603 Forward is not moving forward. They're moving backwards. New Hampshire Republicans are moving the state forward. We're going to continue doing so. We have fair maps. The governor will only sign, will only allow fair maps to go through. He'll veto any maps that don't pass the smell test. All of our maps pass the smell test. They're more than fair.
Okay. All right, let's move on. It's 12:20 here on WASR. Thank you for listening. It is a very wet day, but by the end of the day, the rain should leave us as well. As you know, this week, Governor Sununu making the rather high-profile announcement that he will be running for a fourth term as governor as opposed to running for Senate against Maggie Hassan, who's been classed as vulnerable. So, Senator, let me start with you. Is Hassan vulnerable?
Yes, she is absolutely vulnerable. I mean, you look at, you know, what's going on in the country, And quite frankly, what happened in Virginia and New Jersey, which are blue states, electing a Republican governor fairly easily in Virginia, and in New Jersey came very, very close. I think that, you know, people are reacting to what they're seeing in Washington, and you know, whether it's inflation that's on the march. We just got the October numbers yesterday, worst inflation in 30 years. People are seeing it every time they, you know, go to the supermarket or wherever. Cost of gasoline is up 40%. It's, you know, in many parts of New Hampshire now, it's at $3.50 a gallon and likely to go higher. Home heating costs are going to skyrocket this winter. So inflation and energy problems are real. Then there's Afghanistan and what happened in Afghanistan. And God help us, but I think we're going to be tested as a nation, whether it's Russia and Ukraine, whether it's China and Taiwan, Iran, North Korea, you show the kind of weakness that we showed in Afghanistan, you pay a price for it, to say nothing of the fact that Americans, you know, and our allies were abandoned there. And then the chaos at the southern border, which, you know, you talk about burying your head in the sand. I've never seen anything so outrageous in, you know, the 30 years that I've served in public office. I mean, that's an outrage what is happening there, and it's so preventable. You know, defund the police, which, you know, Joe Biden has, you know, been flirting with, certainly. That's why Maggie Hassan is valuable. She's tied at the hip to those policies. She's going to vote for, you know, this huge infrastructure bill if it gets to the Senate. Thank God for Senator Manchin and Sinema. That'll probably keep it from going too far. But that's why Maggie Hassan's underwater. She is responsible for all those things, you know, I just talked about, because she's an ally of the Biden administration. So I think there are any number of, you know, qualified Republicans that could take her on. And I would just say one more thing, Eric. Everybody has seen her advertising, you know, for a couple of months now. She's really hitting it hard. I mean, I'm seeing it, you know, during the Patriots game. I'm seeing it when the Red Sox were in the playoffs, to say nothing of, you know, on cable or on Channel 9. And she's still underwater. So I think that it's going to be a pretty good year. But it's a long ways to go. You know, this time a year from now, the Friday after the election, I guess we'll be talking about what happened. But right now, I think things are trending our way. And when you get the kind of inflationary pressures that are baked into the economy, and the administration now talking about closing down yet another pipeline, and, you know, begging OPEC to produce more oil, and they're laughing at us, but we're not producing our own, you know, oil. This is having a real impact on hardworking men and women across our state and across our country, and they're not happy. They're really unhappy.
What I don't understand is, we have enough shale oil and deposits to make ourselves energy independent. We have been energy independent under previous administrations. Are these environmental rules? Because at these prices, even shale oil can be very, very profitable.
You know what? When we extract fossil fuels and then we turn them into, you know, fuels, the environmental standards in the United States are among the best in the world, okay? So compare, you know, how we produce oil to what happens in the Middle East. There's almost no comparison environmentally. Do we need to move toward more renewable technologies? Absolutely. I don't think there's anybody in New Hampshire that has worked more for, you know, renewable energy than I have. But it's ridiculous to think that we're just going to flip a switch and people that heat with oil or propane or natural gas or electricity aren't going to be impacted. Or the same thing with our cars. I mean, you know, Karen owns a hybrid Jeep now, and it's a great thing. It's increased the gas mileage, but you don't just change overnight to electric vehicles. It's going to take time, and battery technology has to advance before renewables can break through the reliability conundrum that we have to have, you know, the ability to store the electricity when the sun's shining, when the wind's blowing, you know, that kind of thing. That's our future. But it's not the fuel that we can depend on today. The Biden administration, again, has their head in the sand, and they think that they can close pipelines, they can stop drilling, they can end leases, and they can change the fact that America, you know, just in the last few years was for the first time ever energy independent, to now that we're begging the rest of the world to, you know, send oil and gas our way, and they're wondering why the prices have gone through the roof. I mean, this is just incompetence, Eric. Incompetence. And, you know, again, Maggie Hassan supporting this. We could be moving to a greener future without you know, this Green New Deal that is saying the world's going to end in 9 years or whatever it is. And we can do that, but you can't just be this disruptive to people's lives all across the country. And they're not feeling the pinch. You know, they're in you know, Joe Biden is going in an 85-car convoy in the Vatican, you know, and jetting all over the world in the, you know, the biggest plane known, as are all these other leaders that are in Scotland in their private airplanes. I mean, the hypocrisy of the people, you know, foisting the Green New Deal on us is stunning. Now, I know I'm like kind of sounding a little angry today. Sorry for that, but, you know, I'm like everybody else. I'm just, you know, people are calling me every day. How am I going to pay my bills? How, you know, when's the price of gas going down? Am I going to be able to buy a turkey for Thanksgiving? Is there going to be, you know, Christmas presents that I can buy for my kids or my grandkids? I mean, so, you know, the economy's being run into the ground by people that have no clue what they're doing.
Brody, let me ask you, Senator Hassan is quite probably, at least according to Senator Bradley, vulnerable. What do you think, or who do you think would be a good person to challenge her?
A good person to challenge her? Well, the best was Governor Chris Sununu, but we're going to be blessed with another 2 years of his leadership after he wins re-election. And I'm more than happy to support him and help him with his campaign. Governor has done a great job leading the state through COVID, solving major issues, solving issues like housing, renewable energies, also helping us decrease costs for taxpayers in this state, preventing a sales and an income tax. But who would be the best replacement for Senator Hassan? Because we know she needs to be replaced. We know that she's following lockstep with Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden. We know that we haven't heard hide nor hair ever since she beat Kelly Ayotte, and all of a sudden it's re-election time, and she's showing up on our TVs with big ads paid by Super PAC and big money, begging for us to send her down there again to do what no one knows. But they, you know, you these out-of-state groups want her back, and you got to wonder what their motivation is. But
Well, it's funny. I was just going to ask you that.
I don't think we found the best replacement for Maggie Hassan yet. I still think we need a leader to step up, someone who can unify the Republican Party and to really take this race by the reins, earn the endorsement of Governor Chris Sununu, unify this state, and get ready to run on a ticket with the governor and to support the governor. I think that's the biggest thing that we need going forward. That's the biggest thing that's going to lead to our party's success in 2022. It's going to be about supporting Governor Chris Sununu and his ability of leadership in the Granite State and exporting that leadership down to Washington, D.C., and ensuring that we bring Granite State values to Washington, D.C., not bringing Washington, D.C. politics back to the Granite State like Maggie Hassan has. So I really, at this point, we need someone to step up and really be a leader. It could be, you know, it could be a number of folks. I know Senate President Chuck Moore said he's not ruling it out. He is someone who is a very capable leader who has been able to help Governor Chris Sununu through COVID and through building a stronger economy and through formulating an amazing state budget. I think he has the kind of principles to really be a leader down in Washington, D.C. and show people how to actually run a Senate.
Senator, there is one Republican that has declared his candidacy, if I remember, General Baldock has decided he's going to be a... he's going to take on Representative Hassan, but it's a two-part question. Number one, why are out-of-state interests so interested in this and other races? Is it because they want to try to flip the seat?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you have a, you know, a tight Senate race, a United States Senate race, and you have a 50-50 United States Senate, it is a huge deal for the state of New Hampshire to be one of the probably half dozen states that, along with Georgia and trying to think of, Brody, help me out, maybe it's Colorado, Arizona possibly, that have very competitive, or is it Nevada? I can't
Pennsylvania,
remember all the states,
that's
but
another
there are
one.
Some half a dozen that are very competitive, and it's going to be, you know, millions of dollars spent in New Hampshire on advertising. So, you know, I think that the balance of power in Washington is at stake, and I think, you know, we've seen what's happened in 10 short months, and I think, you know, our efforts in the New Hampshire State Senate, you know, in terms of building for, you know, the 2022 election, we're off to a great start because people are legitimately worried. So, you know, we'll see what happens.
I have a lot of respect for General Bolduc, but he is very much a hardline Republican, serious conservative. Is he electable?
You know, I have a lot of respect for the general too, as to his military campaign. But, you know, when he called Chris Sununu a communist sympathizer, he lost me. Okay, Chris Sununu's been a great governor, and General Bolduc needs to learn that the first call he should have made, rather than blasting Sununu for no reason at all, was to Chris Sununu and tell him what he's thinking. But nope, he called him a communist sympathizer. So I think there are a lot of people that are looking at that and saying,
I missed that one. Wow.
Yeah.
It does.
Wow is right.
That. I have some pretty strong.
Not
to
a
say
smart
about that. No,
Brody, you
point,
said. Go ahead.
I think at this point in the Republican Party, if you're not willing to get behind, in the New Hampshire Republican Party, if you're not willing to get behind Governor Chris Sununu's reelection campaign, and if you're not ready to understand that Governor Chris Sununu is the reason why we won these majorities, why we were able to decrease the budget by 3%, why we were able to get rid of the interest and dividend tax, how we were able to prevent an income tax, a sales tax, a capital gains tax, you name the tax, why we've been able to prevent it, why the Democrats weren't able to destroy our Second Amendment in 2017 and 2018, right? If we're not ready in 2019 and 2020, if we're not ready to admit that and to run with the governor, to support the governor, and to work as a team to get the governor back into the corner office, to help get someone to the Senate instead of Maggie Haston, to get rid of Chris Pappas and Annie Custer, right? If we're not ready to work with the governor, understand that the governor is popular, the governor's leadership is approved highly in both parties, and that the governor's leadership is a standard across the country, then at a certain point, you got to wonder, are those people actually willing to work with the Republicans, and are they actually Republicans, right? Or are they just part of a different ideology, putting an R next to their name and trying to fake it to make it, right? And I think at this point, we have to understand the governor is the leader of our party. He's the leader of our state. It's time for New Hampshire Republicans to back him up, to be proud of what he's done, to be proud of what this party's achieved, and to keep letting voters know what we're doing and what we're going to do and how we're going to build off of those successes with low unemployment, fighting against Biden's inflation, keeping costs low, keeping taxes low, not growing the government, but making it more efficient and maximizing our investments. The governor's done it all. He's not a communist. He's a good, hardworking family man, and he's the biggest reason why we right now have majorities in the state, and he's the biggest reason why we'll grow our majorities in 2022. Okay.
Do you think that the Republican Party may allow him to run unopposed?
Doesn't matter whether
someone
runs against him,
he's going to win
okay,
overwhelming.
Wait a minute. One person at a time.
Approve of him.
I'm sorry, Senator. Please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think there are going to be any number of people that, you know, will step up and run. So there'll be a primary on the Republican side for the U.S. Senate.
You think so?
And it'll probably be a pretty exciting one, too.
I'd hate to vote against. I'd hate to run against him. Let me put it that way. He's quite a dynamic personality.
You mean against Chris Sununu?
Yes.
Oh no, I'm sorry. I thought you meant for U.S. Senate.
Oh no,
Chris Sununu will not have a primary, and you know he'll be the Republican nominee, and I think he's going to do just fine. Brody's right. He's been a great governor, and all the things Brody touched on, he's also been an effective leader through the pandemic. you know, where we've largely kept our economy open and managed the public health implications of the pandemic. And I think, you know, people like Chris Sununu. He's accessible, approachable. You can talk to him. He's polite. Even some would say he's charming, you know. And but people like him. He's a good guy. He's I think he should, by rights, win, you know, his fourth term.
Let's try it this way. He is pretty much lauded among all sides of the political spectrum for doing what he does. Why have so many people not figured out that the great center of America are the ones that do the voting? It seems that all we hear is from the loudness on both fridges.
Yeah, and I think, Eric, that has a lot to do with our primary system, too, when, you know, 20 to maybe 25% of the eligible voters vote the primaries. It skews both the Democratic nominees oftentimes. I mean, look at, you know, the squad, for instance, on, you know, that side. And I think it does the same on the Republican side. And then you get to a general election, you know, you get 70% turnout in a state like New Hampshire of eligible voters. And, you know, the biggest party in New Hampshire are independent voters. No question about that. You cannot win if you can't appeal to independent voters. And I think, you know, somebody like me who's tried to, you know, run a middle-of-the-road, you know, type of political career, somebody who's a problem solver, you know, I've historically done pretty well with independents. I mean, obviously, every election's different and can't take anything for granted, and I knock on wood when I say that, but, you know, no one party, no one individual has a monopoly on every good idea. You got to be able to work with people, you got to be able to listen, you got to be able to bring good ideas together, because oftentimes, you know, both sides have good ideas. And so if you look at whether it's in New Hampshire, whether it's nationally, the most enduring, you know, changes that we've made have been bipartisan. And that's why, you know, what's happening in Washington now that, you know, is so partisan. And I'm not just saying, you know, one side's to blame. Both sides are to blame. And, you know, it just, I think, you know, that's one reason why the ratings of Congress, you know, it doesn't matter who the speaker is, who's in, you know, control of the Senate or the U.S. House, they're so low is because they're so partisan. They fight, and they are unwilling to work together, and it's become chaotic, and people are pretty tired of it.
Especially because when they do those things, people tend to vote for them. That's the part I don't understand here. Brody, let me ask you the same question. We you know, we know about the partisan politics, but why haven't more politicians tacked more center to attract votes? Or is the dogma more important?
It's the dogma. It's the primary process, too, as Senator Bradley touched upon. When you when to survive a primary, you have to appeal to the 10% extreme on either end of the political spectrum. You do things, you know, some politicians will do things they don't necessarily believe so they can survive those especially serious primary challenges, forcing them to move right, or they will cast votes and placate specific ideological motives that don't make a lot of sense to the general public or don't make a lot of sense when you objectively look to public policy, but they'll do it just so they don't have to deal with the loudest on either end of the political spectrum. But I think I've done a very similar job of trying to run a very issues-based campaign and cast my votes as objectively as possible and take input from constituents and Wolfboro as much as possible and bring their concerns down with me to Concord and cast my votes based upon their best interests. And I think if more politicians did that, you know, it would be easier. I think part of it is money in politics, right? There's a lot of people who can be easily swayed by money because they'd rather, you know, be able to hold their position. And another weird thing, too, is while people have very low approval ratings of Congress overall, most people on the aggregate actually like their congressmen or congresswoman, right? So it's kind of this, you have this catch-22 where everyone, you ask voters, do you like your congressman or congresswoman? And right now in America, we're actually at a point where it's pretty rare where actually a lot of politicians have a negative approval rating who are in power in D.C. But typically how it works is politicians in their home district have a positive approval rating, but Congress as a whole is not liked. So people don't like the institution of Congress because they don't, you know, sometimes it's lack of understanding of what's going on and they get confused and they think, you know, that it's just not working when sometimes it's just a lot more complicated and a lot more, you know, the sausage making can be gross and annoying, you know, when they're trying to make this kind of legislation, everything. Part of it is also because it seems like they're doing nothing and all they're doing is, you know, screaming and shouting and trying to fundraise, which there's some truth to that. The difference between, I mean, I think that's the biggest difference between New Hampshire and Washington, D.C., is that in New Hampshire we have a volunteer legislature. It's a lot harder to buy elections in this state. You have to be someone who's respected in your community, who's a volunteer, who cares, and who shows to their constituents that they care and, you know, will be reelected by people who are quite, you know, quite frankly, by your neighbors, right? You have to, you know, your neighbors, they put out your yard signs, maybe they give you $10, $15 to help you campaign a little bit, and you don't really fundraise a lot, right? It's too difficult to buy 400 state rep seats in the state of New Hampshire and to try to convince people who are doing this kind of stuff to volunteer out of the goodness of their heart, right? Same thing's true with the state senate also. They're all volunteers. And so when you're a volunteer and there's no kind of monetary gain for you, you know, you're more at the liberty to do what's best for your community. And while sadly we are seeing, you know, some partisan politics start to increase in New Hampshire with a number of progressive groups that are moving in and trying to essentially buy elections and to implement the sales and an income tax, I think voters have seen right through it, right? These groups were in here last election cycle. They tried to run a campaign where all they talked about was national issues and President Donald Trump, and they lost. Because at the end of the day, New Hampshire voters, they don't want a sales tax. They don't want an income tax. They want the Second Amendment defended. They want streamlined, small, efficient government with maximized investments. They want to ensure personal liberties are protected. They support the governor on the overall aggregate. You know, these groups that come from out of state, New Hampshire, they don't understand how unique our political ecosystem is, and they don't understand that Granite Staters are more in tune and better understand their local politics than they give them credit for. And these, you know, these consultants and donors and, you know, big money groups from New York, California, Virginia, they don't really understand what's actually going on in the Granite State and how voters actually pay attention. They can't fool us.
All right, it's 12:45 here on WASR. Thank you for listening. I'm Eric Scott. Brody Deshaies is with me, State Representative, Wolfboro resident, also Wolfboro resident, and Senate Majority Leader Jeb Bradley. I know we talked about this, Senator, very, very briefly before we went on the air, but I'd like to get a reaction from both of you. Rennie Cushing, the House Democratic leader, wrote Speaker Packard a letter dated today regarding repeated, his word, instances of anti-Semitism, especially from Representative Maria Perez. She tweeted a slogan that has been kind of co-opted, much as Let's Go Brandon has, for the destruction of Israel. And that phrase was, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free." Senator, I'm not sure how to say it. Was that appropriate?
Brody, maybe you can answer this question. Isn't Representative Perez a Democrat?
I believe that she is, yes.
Yeah, so I'm
Representative
not exactly
Perez,
sure
she's
why.
She's a Democrat.
Rennie Cushing, from, I believe, minority leader.
Milford, or either one of the complaining
to
near
the
Milford.
Speaker.
I mean,
wait a minute. One person at a time. Senator, go ahead.
Okay.
Well, all I was saying is I'm not exactly sure why, you know, Rennie Cushing, being the Democratic leader, is complaining to the Speaker about one of his own members. But, you know, I think we have to be very careful about discrimination, bigotry, homophobia, sexism. I think, you know, all of us have a responsibility to, you know, make sure that our public statements or private statements or, you know, what we put on social media are respectful of people's differing, you know, whether it's religious beliefs or, you know, their racial characteristics or their sexual orientation. I think we've got to be, you know, very cognizant of those things and very respectful and even-handed and non-discriminatory. And there has been historically, you know, a lot of anti-Semitism, and there's no place for it. So hopefully Randy Cushing will talk to Representative Perez, and which he's the Democratic leader and certainly has an ability to do that.
Brody, your reaction to that?
Sorry, I can't hear the senator on the other end of the line.
I understand.
That's my apologies. But no, I mean, let's be quite frank. We've seen anti-Semitic statements come from representatives in both parties over the last 12 months. They're absolutely unacceptable. Israel, I'm a strong supporter of Israel. I'm a strong supporter of the Jewish state. I strongly believe that there should be a two-state solution in accordance with the Abraham Accords. I support, you know, funding Iron Dome, which Democrats recently voted to defund and then had to reverse their vote out of fear because a number of prominent Jewish Democrats called them out and refused to give campaign donations unless they reverse their decision. So, I mean, let's be honest here in New Hampshire. We're now starting to see, you know, when you're a representative, you're elected to represent your community, and you are a reflection of the values of your community and the values of our state. There's a reason why before our official titles as representative are, you know, honorable. I am the Honorable Brody Deshaies. I will be until the day I die. That means acting honorably, right? And when you say something or post something that's anti-Semitic, that demeans a specific group, when you do something that's sexist, homophobic, racist, et cetera, and put that online, it's unacceptable. It's unbecoming of you and your position. There should be official kind of either whether it's censorship or censorship as in being censored by the, you know, an official reprimand or something of the similar when representatives behave like that. You know, we need to ensure that our government, that the people who are elected are, you know, meeting the mantle of their office. And I also strongly believe that voters should take note when people say such things or when they post such things, when they promulgate such things, and they should remember next election cycle and really consider, is that someone who I want to represent me, my community, in this state, right? Because that kind of stuff today happening, whether it's, you know, Representative Perez or others, is absolutely unacceptable. It's not defendable. And I would expect representatives in both parties to say, that's not right. Enough is enough. You either need to apologize and accept, you know, accept your punishment or step down. End of story. No ifs, ands, or buts.
All right. Thank you very much for that one, Brody. Appreciate it. We've got a few minutes left, and I wanted to kind of take a focus to our neighbors to the south, specifically in Boston. As you know, we have a new mayor in Boston, Michelle Wu, who is politically aligned herself with the Squad. I don't know if she's officially a member or not, but she's very, very progressive, wants to not charge for public transportation and lots of other projects. Let's start with you, Brody. This could be, if nothing else, a very interesting sociological experiment. Massachusetts has always been a fairly blue state, but now we have a mayor who is way out there on the progressive fringe. Your thoughts?
Yeah, let's put it quite frank. Mayor Wu is left of Lenin. it's utterly insane. You know, she wants to dissolve the Boston Police Department. She wants to, I mean, when you talk, I mean, just that alone, right? just that alone, that's a risk to public safety. The majority of people of color in this country support police officers and support police presence, and actually believe there should be larger police presence in their communities. And meanwhile, you have Mayor Wu sitting in her ivory tower, deciding that she's going to defund the police, has actively attacked first responders publicly. Mayor Wu is so out of touch. I mean, you had Buffalo, New York, just out of Democrats that want to write an election against someone who was like Mayor Wu because people were scared that they're going to defund the police. And the same exact thing in Minneapolis. Minneapolis, one of the most progressive cities in the country, voted against defunding and getting rid of their police department, right? The people of Boston are going to be in for a rude awakening. I would not be surprised if Mayor Wu is a one-term candidate after she gets rid of their police department and things go awry and do not work correctly, just like what happened in Portland when they basically let the anarchists take over sections of their city. And the other thing, too, is now we're starting to see some of those policies creep up into New Hampshire, which is unacceptable, right? Ending qualified immunity would absolutely destroy our ability of to be able to protect and defend our first responders, the thin blue line that defends our communities, right, who we need to support. We have folks right now that think that attacking law enforcement is the best answer to creating more safety in our society. We need better training. We need to recognize that there are historical inequities in policing, but that doesn't mean that you throw the baby out with the bathwater and end qualified immunity for all public workers. Right, we need to find a reasonable approach. I think the governor has found a very reasonable approach with his LEAC committee and creating proposals, working with community activists, racial justice folks, and local law enforcement, and trying to find solutions that everyone can agree upon that are going to create the best results. And I think Senator Bradley has really led the charge in a number of criminal justice reform. The next thing we need to fix, though, is our bail system. Right now, we have an issue of catch and release. That needs to stop. That's not safe for the public. When you have people who, are threatening women and then are arrested and then released on PR bail and then end up going, committing assaulting those women and everything, that's unacceptable. So we need updates to our laws to ensure that our streets are safe, that people can, feel comfortable in their homes, that they're not worried about criminals hurting them or even loved ones who have threatened them hurting them. But we also need to be reasonable and understand that there's a balance of people's civil liberties. But at a certain point, folks like Michelle Wu are making that impossible with ridiculous and absurd proposals.
Senator, your thoughts on this? I mean, we had Bernie Sanders as mayor of Burlington for quite a while, and the world did not end, nor did he defund the police department. But your thoughts on some of what Mayor Wu has been talking about? I mean, is she...
Honestly, I have to admit I haven't paid much attention to it. I think Brody hit the nail on the head. And I think the results will be more Massachusetts residents fleeing Massachusetts and coming to New Hampshire. We're seeing that because, we have one of the strongest economies in the country, among the lowest unemployment rates, lowest poverty rate, high per capita income, opportunity to work here, start a business here, all that kind of thing. I suspect that we'll see even more migration to New Hampshire.
What is it about, we've heard it, the New Hampshire advantage? I know that, we just talked about kind of the highlights of it, but when you look at states like Louisiana or Mississippi, which rank at or near the bottom of most ratings for different things, what is it that's special about New Hampshire that enables us to keep going the way we've been going?
Well, we're one of the only states in the country that has neither a general sales tax or an income tax. We don't have a capital gains tax. We manage our affairs, whether it's at a local level or at a state level, pretty efficiently. So, our overall per capita tax burden is relatively low. We have a highly educated workforce. We believe in work. So that's why, and there's plenty of opportunity. And we have one of the lowest poverty rates in the country. We're a beautiful state to live in. We have a great environment with the mountains, the seacoast, really nice villages. You know, so all of those things, I think consistently, that's why, Eric, we, I think, have always been, in, ever since they've been doing it, among the very top states in the, excuse me, the U.S. News and World Report's, you know, ranking of states on their most livable. We're safe. That's another big thing. We have decent infrastructure. That's another big thing. Our education system is good. So we're an attractive state to live in. And we've laid the groundwork over the last 7 or 8 years by the smart policies that we've adopted in terms of great economic, you know, success for the state. So as long as we continue to do that, we're going to be attractive to move and live to and start a business. That's the New Hampshire advantage.
All right. We got just a couple of minutes left, and I wanted to ask Brody especially about this COP26 going on in, was it Switzerland, I believe? The climate summit where everybody flew in. I guess the question is, whose responsibility is it to guide New Hampshire into a less carbon future?
I'll tell you easily, every individual. Every individual, I mean, that's where the biggest change starts. Every individual needs to consider where their waste will end up, and whether it's carbon or streamline, you know, recyclable plastic, metals, you know, other household things that you throw out, or, you know, car oil if you do your own oil change. You have to consider where your waste will go, right? And so people always want this to be government-like, right? They want, oh, how is the government going to solve this problem? But the government can only do so much, and at a certain point when they're trying to create these incentives, they end up doing more to hurt the economy. They end up doing more to hurt consumers, and they don't end up creating the results that we expect. It's on consumers to be cognizant, to be understanding, to be reasonable, and to make the investments that's best for them and their family at that time. And yes, we can do stuff like, you know, support net metering, so when people make good investments, they're rewarded, and so they're, you know, the government's not increasing costs on them. We can build the infrastructure, help incentivize the building of infrastructure, like, for example, the town of Wolfboro, without raising any taxes. They implemented 3 new charging stations. It was going to be 2. Now they were able to afford 3 based on donations from local businesses, individuals, and getting a grant. You know, Senator Bradley has helped in the last budget, helped get more grants and money onto our Route 93 corridor to incentivize more building of green infrastructure, specifically charging stations. So we can build these kind of charging stations and everything without creating a burden on taxpayers. Make it so that when people get these cars and make these investments, that, you know, that they're rewarded and that they're able to do that. But at the end of the day, it's on individuals to really say, you know, saving, you know, an electric car is going to save me money in the long run. It's going to be a good investment for myself and my family. It's going to help the environment. And those are all 3 boxes that, you know, that check different interests within my life. And, you know, people just need to be cognizant, right? When you leave the room, turn off a light. When you're not at home, you know, maybe turn down the heat a little bit, right? It's just small little steps like that that can really go a much longer way than a one-size-fits-all bureaucratic answer.
All right. Thank you very much, Brody. Appreciate it. Thank you, Brody Deshaies, Wolfboro resident and state representative, and Senator Jeb Bradley, Senate Majority Leader and Wolfboro resident. Thank you both very much for the time.
Thank you, Eric. Have a good weekend.
You too. Brody, take
care.
Thank
you, Eric. Thank you for having me.
We'll talk next week. It's 101. The news is next.